Hey everyone, it's Colin. How's it going? You may hear some noise in the background, and I'm sorry about that, but it is kind of pertinent to this episode. I've got my 3D printer running, and I'm producing some more of those SE and SE30 SCSI to SD brackets that fit in the back of those compact Macs for swapping out the internal SCSI hard drive for the SCSI to SD module. And while setting up that print job, you know, it really got me thinking about where we've really evolved into when it comes to dealing with retro tech and not just restoring it, but enhancing it and kind of what the path forward really is going to look like. Generally, what we had been seeing for a long time, even though the concept of retro tech collecting and as a hobby is relatively new, generally, when you think about it, what most people imagine is just restoration kind of work, right? Like, you know, finding a machine in the basement or the attic or the garage that's dirty and going through cleaning it up, reinstalling the software on it, maybe doing some kind of repair work, usually in the form of replacing capacitors on motherboards and that sort of thing. But in general, just putting the machine kind of back the way it was or should have been when it was new. And that's great. And obviously that's going to continue. But I'm also seeing some really interesting developments that not only help that effort and expand on it in different ways, but also go even further, kind of like how we've seen with retro game consoles, right? I mean, I kind of got my start on YouTube working on content about how do you make things like Game Boys better? Not just, you know, taking them and fixing them up. Like if you've got one that's got a bad screen or one with a really nasty looking housing, you know, how do you swap all the guts into a new shell? But things like screen modifications, adding backlights, right? Like all these sorts of mods. And as time has gone on, we've seen just increasingly compelling and advanced upgrades made available for all of these consoles that are like 30 plus years old at this point, right? I mean, some of this stuff is just getting ancient in terms of, you know, where we are today for technology, but just the things that people have been able to add to old systems from like the 80s and early 90s to get the absolute most they can out of them is very, very impressive. And I've been seeing similar things start to develop for retro computing, and I can't help but be excited. Obviously, with restoration kind of stuff, there's always going to be that undercurrent of just component level repair, right? And the vast majority of it for pretty much all computers is going to be things like capacitors on motherboards and in power supplies, either surface mount or through hole. And as time goes on, we'll see an increasing number of people learn how to do those repairs themselves just because of the nature of them becoming increasingly common. If you don't want to do any of that kind of work yourself, you've got really two choices. You can either buy a machine that hasn't had that problem happen to it yet, where, you know, it just happens to be at that particular end of the bathtub curve where, you know, the parts haven't really started completely failing yet for whatever reason, and it just works and it's still original, or a machine that's already been restored or repaired by someone else. The thing is, all of those machines in that first category, it's going to happen to them, right? I think some people have this belief that certain pieces of retro tech are going to have problems and certain other ones won't. Like it's just a luck of the draw kind of a thing. You know, that some computers will never have their batteries leak or have their capacitors leak or have plastic get brittle or whatever. That just, you know, some of these machines happen to be lucky ones and other ones won't. The thing to understand, and it takes a lot to accept, is the fact that every single computer, every single retro computer is going to fail at one point or another, like it or not. And that's tough for me to accept, especially with the machines I have in my collection that are sentimental, right? One of the machines that I've got that I did not intentionally put out in the storage unit that I actually keep at home is my LC575. That was the first Mac my family bought, right? I remember distinctively when we went out shopping for it, we ended up actually buying the computer. It was kind of this long, almost like a wild goose chase of, you know, trying different stores and trying to kind of mix and match all the parts to get the right pricing and everything. Because remember, in the early 90s, computers were relatively a lot more expensive than they are now. So I remember going with my family, you know, from store to store, looking at what they had available and all the different models and everything. And we almost bought an open box LC550 from, I think, Circuit City. And it was a really good price, but the 575 was just that much better. So we ended up going to Best Buy to pick up one of those, but it was in box and, you know, brand new, sealed and everything. So it was, you know, more expensive, but the price was worth it. But Best Buy wanted more money for the inkjet printer than Circuit City did. So we ended up going back to Circuit City to buy the inkjet printer. I think we got a StyleWriter 2. You know, and meanwhile, like the box for the 575, you know, that's an all-in-one computer. So the box is huge and it didn't completely fit in the trunk of the car. Right. So we're driving around with this box, you know, hanging out the trunk, and the trunk is open as we're driving around. You know, so I've got some sentimental attachment to that machine. Right. I played the hell out of SimCity 2000 on it, and I played Myst on it and Riven and all the other really kind of immersive, like CD-ROM games, you know, Descent and all that stuff. And I got just tons of homework done on it. I built my very first website on it. I love that machine. And it's actually a very popular model in retro circles, the LC575. But I have to accept the fact that it is going to fail in various ways over time. I've already had to recap the motherboard, although I did that more as a preventative thing. The caps had started to leak, but no damage had been done. But there still is a lingering sound problem with it, where it'll make noise out the headphone jack on the motherboard, but the internal speakers don't work. So that's probably an analog board problem. Likely, I'll have to recap the analog board at some point, because no doubt I'm going to end up with, you know, video problems on that machine. The CRT is going to start acting weird, and the image is going to look all funky. And then the other thing that is really tough to accept, and this goes for a lot of computers and not just Macs, is brittle plastics. And I've already started to experience that a little bit on that machine, where the hard drive inside a lot of the Macs from the 90s physically mounts to a plastic sled, and it goes into kind of a quick release type of thing where there's an edge connector that you can plug into the SCSI connector on the drive itself. And it goes into an edge connector, you know, inside the chassis of the computer to make swapping a drive quick and easy. The plastic tab that latches the hard drive in place on that sled that it rides in on my 575 has already broken off. Now, thankfully, the friction fit of that edge connector is tight enough where the drive isn't going anywhere. But if that plastic tab is already broken, and that's a tab that sits inside the computer, so there's no UV exposure to worry about with that, that doesn't bode well for the rest of the machine. So one of the reasons why I didn't take it out to storage is because, quite frankly, I don't think it would have survived the trip. Like, I'm afraid to carry the thing around. I'm tempted one of these days, if I ever get free time, which is kind of a joke because I never have free time, but if I ever do, I'm actually tempted sooner rather than later to pull the thing out, set it all up, and just shoot a ton of B-roll of it while it's in good shape before it degrades. And as soon as the case starts cracking on it, even though it hides in the closet, it's out of the sunlight, there's no UV, you know, it still is yellowing. And the plastic is still sitting there silently turning brittle. And I know someday I'm just going to go to pick it up and the thing's going to crumble. And that happens to a lot of other stuff. I've seen tons of like PC laptops, even from the 90s, either ones in my collection or ones that have gone through like at Free Geek Twin Cities that I've seen, where plastics are starting to crack on them for the same reason. These machines just weren't designed to be collectible in the future, right? They were, you know, intended to be used for 3 to 5 years, and then they would just be completely obsolete and people would move on to new machines and the old ones would get thrown out. So dealing with those sorts of issues has been and will continue to be an even bigger problem. Now, thankfully, that's where a lot of the advanced development and extra work has started to come into play, where you've got things like 3D printing, and people have produced 3D printed replacement parts, obviously smaller ones, for fixing up machines. Like a common thing that I've seen are like on CRT monitors. Oftentimes there's a little flip down door in the front that covers the controls and the buttons and everything just to make the front of the monitor kind of look cleaner and nicer. Oftentimes either the little latch or the hinge pegs on that door will break off because the plastic gets brittle. And so I've seen people design and print replacement parts, either little new pegs that you can glue onto the existing door or just an entire replacement door. Another common problem back to the Mac side of things is like the front bezel on the tower machines, like the things like the Quadra 800, if you're familiar with that model. The bezels that go around the drive bays have little plastic hooks that clip that bezel to the rest of the front panel. And obviously those hooks are small and kind of flimsy. And so you accidentally touch that bezel piece the wrong way and oops, they crumble. And now that thing has fallen off. So people are going to the time and effort of designing and 3D printing replacement, you know, front bezel pieces that can go on there again as these plastics just age and degrade. Perhaps the most ambitious thing I've seen in terms of cases is there's a group called MacFX, and they've gone kind of to the logical conclusion of all of this, and I can only hope that they continue with it. And they went out and actually 3D modeled and injection molded entire replacement cases. They started with like the Mac SE series, and I think they've got a few other models that they've done as well, where it's not some sort of rinky-dink 3D printed. It's obviously a fake kind of a thing. I mean, they've intentionally made it look like it's a replacement part, because otherwise they would get in trouble with Apple if they went too close to the original. But they put in a lot of time and a lot of money to get an accurate replacement part made. And for a couple $100, you could buy one of these replacement housings to just swap all the guts from your original, you know, Mac SE into. And the thing that they did to make it look more unique, which I have mixed feelings about, is they actually produce them using clear plastic. So the whole thing is kind of translucent. You can see the components inside and everything. I think it looks really cool. Why I'm a little hesitant about it and why I wouldn't necessarily buy one for myself is because there are a few incredibly rare machines out there that were produced with that clear plastic, and they were Apple prototypes. Apple would produce with every new model like a clear version of the enclosure, and apparently that was being used for not just kind of tolerance testing, just to make sure all the parts fit inside the machine. Obviously, that's a lot easier if you can see it from all angles, you know, with a clear enclosure, but also apparently for airflow testing. You know, they could use like a smoke generator, and with the fans in the computer running, you could see the smoke kind of make its way through and out to confirm that the enclosure has proper airflow. So, you know, those prototype clear machines obviously fetch a ton of money because they are incredibly rare. Like in the case of the Color Classic, I'm aware of only like three of those being in existence, or at least out in the wild, right? And so now you've got this company coming along creating replacement enclosures that look just like these prototypes. I don't think it necessarily devalues the prototypes, but it does make them, I think, a little less special because now you're just seeing these enclosures out there. Granted, they look cool, and it's getting that coolness in the hands of a bunch of people, right? Instead of it being this super elite thing, wow, you're one of three people on planet Earth who have a clear Mac SE or whatever, you know, now you've got potentially hundreds of people who can, if they're willing to cough up the, I'd like to say those enclosures were like $250 or something like that. They weren't cheap, but they were attainable. I mean, $250 is a lot less money than what one of the prototypes would sell for. But I hope that sort of thing actually continues. I would love to see them do another production run of a variety of machines in just the regular kind of beige plastic. Because, you know, as much as I fear it, you know, when my 575 housing starts to degrade, when my Color Classic, which is another machine that I've got sentimental value for, I mean, when its plastics start to go, I would really like to be able to keep that machine in its form factor around instead of just going, well, you know, the plastics are shot. There's nothing I can do. I can either hodgepodge some 3D parts together, maybe, but if those parts are structural or large pieces, you know, at some point, otherwise, you just have to kind of say goodbye to the machine. So seeing that ambitiousness of, we really, really want to see this legacy continue, and putting the, I think, hundreds of thousands of dollars into like the design and tooling of big scale replacement parts like that, I think that's a really good step towards preserving the legacy of these machines. And it's not just an appearance thing too. I've seen projects where I think there's someone out there who reverse engineered the entirety of the Mac SE motherboard. You can tell the Mac SE is definitely a soft spot for some people. But they like reverse engineered, you know, went through what schematics were available and everything and designed brand new replacement motherboard PCBs, because having caps leak or the, you know, the clock battery explode and destroy traces and components and all that, that's again becoming a much more common thing to see. So having a replacement PCB that you can just transfer all of the specialty chips from a donor motherboard over to, that's huge. And that's very ambitious. Thankfully, that's a lot less cost to make it happen, not just in terms of development, but also selling them. I think those boards only go for $50 or so. So it's pretty attainable for a lot of people. Doing that kind of repair on your own, like desoldering all these surface mount chips and moving them over, yeah, you need to have some skill there, but it's definitely not impossible. And it's something that I think a lot of people could certainly learn. So that's, I think, from a restoration perspective, really the frontier is going beyond just how do you replace these commodity parts on motherboards like capacitors and batteries and that sort of thing, going into whole scale like replacement parts, like enclosures or PCBs, or trying to find ways to work around proprietary components or chips that may be prone to failure, right? You know, kind of like think Back to the Future of the movie, you know, Back to the Future 3, you know, Doc Brown had to cobble together all those parts strapped to the hood of the DeLorean to, you know, make up for a fried IC, you know, in the car from when it got struck by lightning. You know, if you remember that scene, I don't know, maybe I'm old, but kind of like that, right? Like, but in reverse. Can we do stuff now? Can we use modern technology to fix up and work around problems in these old computers? The answer is yes. And that frontier just keeps expanding. But the same technologies that allow us to fix up these old machines are also going a long way into letting us enhance them beyond things just like floppy emulators, which are pretty awesome in their own right. Like on the PC side, the GoTech is one of the most popular ones. On the Mac, you've got things like the floppy emu. You've got hard drive replacements. There's the SCSI to SD, like I was saying earlier. Plus there's a newer one called Blue SCSI. There's also another one based around the Raspberry Pi that can emulate a SCSI hard drive, but it can do other stuff as well, like networking and all of this. And a lot of that becomes software defined and not just hardware. So the ability for it to expand and do more things, you know, really just, it doesn't involve a lot of cost. Once you've got hardware that's capable and flexible enough to do software defined functions, like a Raspberry Pi, suddenly now, you know, you can go in many different directions at the same time. Instead of your product being focused on just one thing, like this is a floppy drive emulator, now it's like, well, okay, I can have it do this and I can have it do that. And the value add just becomes so much better. I think what we have yet to see is things like, what about displays, you know, LCD panels? And CRTs, of course, are one thing, although granted, a lot of the problems with CRTs that we see are in the analog board, the power supply, and not so much the glass tube itself. Yes, burn-in and dimming and all that is a thing, but I think CRT tubes tend to have more life in them than people otherwise believe, especially since not very many people are going to leave a retro CRT turned on all the time these days, kind of like the way they were used, you know, way back when they were new. You know, you generally turn on a retro computer for half an hour at a time, you tinker with it, and then you turn it all off. So if there are good CRTs out there still, I have a feeling the tubes themselves will last a while, and we'll just need to look at, you know, how do you maintain and repair the circuitry that drives the CRT, getting people more knowledge and more comfortable with doing it, because CRT repair has always been this thing that a lot of people have been afraid of, and justifiably so, because of the high voltages involved. And I think in some ways, the fear is not necessarily unfounded, but perhaps a little bit bigger than it should be. Just like with any other sort of working on technology and electronics, if you understand how the technology works and how to safely work with it, it's a lot less scary and a lot safer than you otherwise would be led to believe, right? A lot of people think, oh, CRT dangerous. If I look at it the wrong way, it'll zap me and kill me. You know, if you're being dumb about it and treating it carelessly, yeah, it can hurt you. But if you understand how it works and how to properly handle it, then it can be safe or safer to work on. And I think we need to get to that point more. I think I kind of feel like we've got this position when it comes to CRTs of you've got a small number of people who actually do understand them and are capable of repairing them and are confident in doing that kind of work. And a lot of other people who just see what those people do as black magic and they're too afraid. Otherwise, you know, we can't let that knowledge die. We need to make sure that that knowledge gets passed on to like the next generation of people who can repair things like CRTs. So while I think we have a pretty decent path forward, relatively sustainable for CRTs, LCDs are going to be another problem, in that we've seen a couple of problems crop up so far that are becoming, unfortunately, more and more common with panels that are in their kind of 30s or so, right? Like LCD monitors for desktops are a relatively new thing, right? We've only seen them be kind of mainstream for the last 20 years or so, but LCD panels as a technology goes much further back. And we've seen laptops since the 80s include them. It's machines from kind of the 90s where laptops started to become more popular that a lot of these problems are arising. And unfortunately, we aren't at a point where people have solid evidence as to what causes these problems or what's necessary to fix it. One common problem is what's called tunnel vision, or like this vignetting of the outside corners of the LCD as it's on and working over time. And we're talking like, you know, maybe minutes to hours of being on and working. Those outer corners kind of like shrink the visual area of the display and you can't see them anymore. That's why they call it tunnel vision. And there's really no firm explanation as to what's causing it. A couple of good theories, one of which led people to trying some fixes. And the theory that I think makes the most sense is that it's humidity related, that moisture is somehow getting inside the layers of the LCD and causing the LCD to stop working correctly. And some people have tried doing things like taking an LCD panel and sticking it in the oven for a little while because it's a hot and dry environment to drive out that moisture. And while they did see good results from doing that, the problem is that those results were only temporary. And so now that's leading into kind of this discussion about like, why is it happening? What's allowing the moisture to get in there? And I think the most plausible explanation is due to failing adhesive within the layers of the LCD. How do you fix that? Well, that's going to take a lot more research and testing to try to figure out. Another common problem that we're starting to see more is what people are calling the vinegar syndrome, where it's like the front surface of the LCD is starting to turn kind of gooey and sticky. And that seems to be related to the front polarizer layer and potentially, again, an adhesive problem. How do you fix that? Some people are surmising that it's as simple in quotation marks as like peeling off the outer polarizer and applying a new one. But what kind of polarizer do you need to get? Can you get the right one for that particular panel? Are you able to apply it in such a way, like on your own, where it still looks good? Because remember, a lot of these, you know, these panels were all produced on an assembly line, usually by robots, right? So you can get perfection out of a factory, but can you get someone to be able to get a perfect looking display repair while just, you know, doing the work at their kitchen table? I'm not so sure. And there are some workarounds for this in the form of just new old stock or used replacement panels, right? A great example is the episode I did on the PowerBook Duo. I've got a Duo 270C that came to me with a broken LCD panel. I would have not been able to find a new old stock replacement if I had just been searching for Duo 270C LCD, like on eBay or whatever, just because those parts were relatively limited to begin with when they were new. And imagine trying to find, you know, some treasure trove of new old stock Apple repair parts somewhere. Yeah, get real. But I was able to find out that the panel was apparently a commodity part used in other applications. Like in this case, it was, I think, used by some companies that manufacture like big industrial CNC machines. It was the screen that they would use on that to control the interface, you know, the big CNC robot thing inside. And I was able to find that by Googling the manufacturer part number on the back of the panel. That panel was made by Sharp. So I got lucky in being able to try to find a replacement part that would work, but that isn't always going to be the case for everyone. So how do we fix these retro laptops, Mac or PC? Well, it's going to take a lot more doing in terms of research and see if there are like kind of homegrown remedies for some of these things. Otherwise, it may come down to taking that other approach of producing brand new parts and, you know, what kind of costs would be involved in that? And would a manufacturer be willing to even take on redesigning a retro part like that and doing a relatively small production run? I think because of how rather tight-knit the retro tech communities are, whether it's computing or gaming or otherwise, we tend to forget just how relatively few of us there actually are. Not to say that the scene isn't continuing to grow, because it is, but some people have this unrealistic expectation that a lot of these parts should just be cheap, right? Because they have the notion of, well, there's got to be a lot of people who would want one of these things, and it's really inexpensive to have stuff made in China. So, you know, why do these Game Boy LCD replacement kits like the IPS mods, you know, why don't those cost like $20? You know, they look at it and go, $60 for one of these, that's too much damn money. I see that in the comments of those videos all the time. And the fact of the matter is, it costs a lot more than they expect to develop that stuff and manufacture it to begin with. And two, the audience is a lot smaller. So that's going to be the other limiting factor, I think, with a lot of what's to come for doing these retro tech repairs. It's not so much that we can't develop ways to produce replacement parts. It's that the economic factors of doing so are just prohibitive. I mean, you think about it, going back to that Mac FX replacement external case for the Mac SE and the other models that they do, they sell for a couple hundred dollars. It's just a piece of plastic, right? As someone who didn't understand that what went into producing that and the costs involved in doing so, they'd look at that and go, $250 for people? Get out of here. That's a ripoff, right? Well, no, not really. Not if it costs them hundreds of thousands of dollars to have molds made and tests and all this, you know, the 3D design to begin with and all this kind of stuff. You know, they're not going to sell millions of them. And I think that's the most unfortunate thing about the future of retro tech in general, is it's always going to be a somewhat limited audience. And at the same time, the scope is going to continue to expand. Because every year, something new becomes retro, if that makes sense, right? I mean, it's generally kind of like a 20-ish year cycle. Once a piece of tech is 20 years old, and sometimes in some cases younger than that, but in general, we've seen if it's 20 years old, people start to get kind of nostalgic for it again. And so that scope is just going to keep continuing to increase. And all of these new retro things that have their own limitations in common failure modes and problems are just going to kind of keep getting added to the pile. I don't want it to, you know, sound like this is an insurmountable problem, because it's not. I think a lot of it comes down to setting expectations. But I am hopeful that with other new technology that's coming out, and, you know, like just the advancements in performance that we've seen for things like the Raspberry Pi, right? The modern ones are so much faster than the very first one. If we can continue to keep, you know, modern technology advancing and have products that are usable in those ways, you know, as long as things like the Raspberry Pi continue to exist, as long as hobbyist kind of level microcontrollers and all that kind of, you know, continue to exist, that things don't become so closed down and proprietary that suddenly it's only big companies that can ever deal with them. As long as we continue to have a vibrant modern technology hobby scene, I think that's going to bode really well for making sure that all of our retro tech can keep going now and into the future. As always, thanks for listening.